So, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for being here. If I could just pull up my notes, technology, okay. So, thank you for being here this evening. My name is Lutfi Siddiqui. I'm a visiting professor in practice at the Center for International Studies at LSE, and also an advisory board member of the Systemic Risk Center, and a member of the Court of Governors at LSE. I'm very pleased to welcome all of you here, as I am of the distinguished panel that's present today. The title of the talk today is Artificial Intelligence and Systemic Risk. So let's do this. Okay, Google, what's artificial intelligence?
According to Wikipedia, artificial intelligence is intelligence demonstrated by machines, in contrast to the natural intelligence displayed by humans and other animals.
Okay, Google, what's systemic risk?
According to Wikipedia, in finance, systemic risk is the risk of collapse of an entire financial system or entire market, as opposed to risk associated with any one individual entity, group, or component of a system that can be contained therein without harming the entire system.
Okay, so I got Google to do some of the work for me. With artificial intelligence taking over human intelligence, whether it's driving cars or outplaying us at games, is the financial system next? That's the question that we're going to try and answer. Is AI, advanced analytics, is it going to stabilize or destabilize the system? Might AI even be the cause for the next financial crisis? When I think of AI, I think of two or three things. First of all, my son, who was 7 years old at the time, a couple of years ago, I remember overhearing him saying to his younger brother, who was four at the time, we really need to listen to Dad, because he has seen more future than us. and I thought that phrase is quite profound. He obviously didn't know the word experience, but he felt that this expressed what he was trying to say. He has seen more future than the rest of us. And maybe we'll talk about this, that whether AI, which depends on the data set from which it learns, is able to see the future, is able to tackle circumstances that may not have been taught to it. The second thing that comes to mind is, you might remember a few years ago, tweets about Anne Hathaway caused the share price of Berkshire Hathaway to go up. And I thought this is something of the past, that technology must have moved on a lot since then. But it turns out, as recently as December last year, this company on NASDAQ, and you would remember this, it's a beverage company, decided to change its name to blockchain something, and the share price went from $2 a share to $6 a share as a spike, from beverage to blockchain. So, and the third thing, I guess, if we're talking about systemic risk, to me the parallel is, are we comfortable moving from the concept of autonomous cars, which most people seem to think is positive, to an autonomous traffic system? Or take it even further, an autonomous air traffic system. How comfortable would we be with that? Because why not? With advanced analytics and better regulatory surveillance, what could possibly go wrong? So for those of you on Twitter, please do tweet along. The hashtag is LSEAI. I would ask you to put your phones on silent, please, and also remind you that the event is being recorded. Hopefully there'll be a podcast and a video made available, unless there are technical difficulties. We also have a photographer here to capture the event, and a selection of photos will be made available on the website. And if you do not want to be in the images that will be published, please do let us know in advance. If you don't want to be in the recording, please try and sit towards the back, behind the camera, or outside the viewfinder. There is...
Sorry, it's the noise of the photographer. I know you can't help it with the camera, but it's becoming an interference.
Okay, that's a good point. If you wouldn't mind perhaps going a little further back, I guess that might help. There is no fire alarm testing scheduled for today, so if you hear it, it's probably real.
Or artificial.
And so you'll be instructed to leave the building, and so please do so immediately, as it will not be an exercise. So let me now introduce my panelists. If I may, I'd like to start with Iva McAleer. She is a co-investigator of the Systemic Risk Center and associate professor in law at LSE Law Department. She is currently working on a Science Research Council grant on automating regulation. And she's also part of a European expert group advising the Commission on Corporate Governance. We were supposed to have a gentleman here from the FCA who couldn't make it, as there was apparently a child is unwell, so he had to rush back home. And Eva was quite impressed by the fact that that a man was taking responsibility and has gone to do that. We have Ken Benoit, Professor Ken Benoit. And again, it is Benoit. I'm not anglicizing it just because there's Brexit and all that, but it really is Ken Benoit, who's Professor of Quantitative Social Research Methods and head of the Department of Methodology. He's also the current director of the Social Economic Data Science Research Unit. And then last but not least, our very own John Danielson. John is co-director of the Systemic Risk Center and associate professor of finance here at LSE. Ladies and gentlemen, a round of applause for the panel, please. Ken, if I may start with you, if you wouldn't mind, help set the scene for us, giving us a sense of what we should be thinking about when we say AI, how should we frame this, and what have been some of the advances in recent years that makes data science so powerful now?
Thank you very much for the introduction. Is my mic working? Is that coming through clearly? I haven't tested yet. Okay, good. Right, so I've been asked to basically... A little bit louder. Maybe if I reposition the microphone.
So there are some seats at the front if you'd like to... if you'd prefer
a little bit of
that.
Speaking of machine learning... Not sure how to place this clip. Just want to make let's try that. How's that? Is this one on? Okay. Anyway, I just wanted to make sure you could hear me before I just start rambling on. So I've been asked to basically give a brief introduction about setting the stage for what machine learning means in this context. And let me start that out by giving you a little bit of background about myself. So first of all, I feel like I know very little about machine learning. But having said that, I taught all day yesterday seminars in machine learning, and I published in machine learning, but I'm not a computer scientist. My background is a social scientist, and so my use of machine learning is very much in the applications. I know a lot about the applications of machine learning. I also should say I really don't know anything about systemic risk. I'm not a finance person, so I'll be giving you a perspective of someone who studies social processes and mostly political processes using things like text analysis and machine learning and social media is something that I've done a lot of work in. So what is machine learning? What is artificial intelligence? Artificial intelligence is, if we're really honest, it's a little bit of a clickbait title to draw you into this forum, because artificial intelligence is a very big field which refers to getting machines to mimic the process of human intelligence. Whatever that means. I have a colleague at Imperial, director of the data science unit there, Yike Guo, and he hates the term artificial intelligence. He says that it's a very human-centric, it's an anthropocentric biased term where we're trying to impose the way that we think on machines, and we should just let them think the way that they're going to think without trying to get into metaphysical issues about whether they're actually smart and what that means to talk about a machine being smart compared to a human. we usually associate the idea of intelligence with some sort of sentience, and it's not necessary whatsoever for machines to be sentient, for us to have some concept of them being intelligent. So what I'm going to really talk about is machine learning, because that is something that's more tractable. This is the idea that we would feed data to machines, where a machine doesn't need to be a blinking robot. It basically can mean a computational machine. And the computational machine learns patterns from the data that we either tell it in a supervised machine learning setting, or we let it learn patterns on its own in an unsupervised machine learning setting. The real advances in machine learning these days, and this is why I say I feel like I know very little, because it's one of these areas where even if I were to quit everything and study deeply and upskill all my knowledge, then maybe at the end of 1 month I would be almost current. And if I were to then go on vacation, a month later I wouldn't be current anymore. The pace is advancing so rapidly, and some of the real advances in this area are not being done in the academic sphere. They're being done by companies delivering essential products for mankind, like how to get you to click on things when you're scrolling through a Facebook feed, for example. They're being done by companies in the social media sphere for the purposes of business. But they're also being done for delivering things like self-driving cars or the Internet of Things. So this idea of machine learning, the advances are in this area of neural networks. And neural networks are the idea that you let the machine form relationships between patterns of input data, much in the same way that the human brain forms these patterns of input. That it learns things that, instead of saying we're going to have two categories of input data and we're going to tell the machine that this is all pictures of cats, this is all pictures of dogs, and it's going to learn the differences between those two things and then project onto unknown data information it's learned about pictures of cats and dogs. With deep learning processes, you just bombard the system with a bunch of sensory type of input data, and it learns that there are two distinct patterns of attributes, and one of those is later told this is actually this is what we call a dog, and this is what we would call a cat. The machine doesn't need to know that in advance because it learns those distinctions through a process of just being bombarded with data. And the concern of people like Elon Musk and others who say that artificial intelligence poses a threat to humanity is ultimately these machines are so sophisticated and they're running on such hardware that is so rapid in forming layers of what they call convolution and other network layers and the equivalent of brain synapses so rapidly and so deeply and in ways that we don't fully understand that we're not able to predict the outputs of those systems. So we think it's learning about cats and dogs, but it might be learning what Skynet learns in Terminator and decide that humans are a nuisance and one day just take us out. There are a lot of other concerns related to that. I'm sure we'll get into some of those concerns. But I thought I would finish my comments by telling you one thing that I'm happy to talk about later, which is applications of this to natural language. So one of the interesting things that is different from the traditional sort of comfortable units you would have in finance, where you analyze units of currency or units of value and nice numeric units that are nice, what we call ratio level data in social science statistics. Natural language is a very qualitative form of input data. It's a form of data that conveys all sorts of rich things because it mimics how humans think. And a lot of people think we can't even shape our thoughts without language. So it's qualitative. For us to analyze that using computers or statistics, we have to destroy language by converting it into numbers. Once we've converted it into streams of numbers or numbers, then we can feed that into machine learning systems. And that's the sort of work that I do. It's the intersection of quantitative analysis and qualitative analysis, and it's a very exciting field because it allows us to pick up increasingly everything we do is recorded as data, and a lot of this data is text. We leave reviews on product sites. We communicate via social media. You're probably sending tweets about this event, hopefully using the hashtag. You have access to these sources of text through the internet and through publicly available gateways or APIs, and there's a lot of analysis you can do. There are entire industries whose purpose is to analyze that text and help firms extract value and do things like predict risk and systemic risk. And those are the sort of techniques that I work on. So let me say something before I finish about the challenges of this for our current frameworks of knowledge. We have some real challenges for our frameworks of knowledge in learning what this brave new world, how it works, and incorporating this into the ways that we've traditionally studied fields like the social science fields that we do at the London School of Economics, including finance, including economics. We're very good at econometrics, and I think you guys in finance are very good at the mathematics for optimization, for determining basically classic ways to make money. When it comes to machine learning and applying this to the volumes of data that we now have access to, even if this means the more classical type of analysis, the volumes of data are so incredibly vast and may be coming at real time with incredibly fine-grained regularity. The volume of trades, for example, the volume of tweets is up to 400 million a day. For social media, that's a problem I'm familiar with. We need new skills that are, frankly, hard to learn. And if you think of the revolutions in social science training we've had, people in economics and finance, the economics fields, you've been doing econometrics for a long time. My field of political science, we had to catch up with you by teaching our students quantitative methods or applied statistical methods, econometric methods. We're a lot more caught up now. We're all behind when it comes to computation. Computer scientists are leading the pack with very advanced methods. Most of them don't have the first clue about how to apply those to the study of social or economic processes, and they may not be very aware or may not be very concerned with some of the ethical or regulatory implications of the technologies that their knowledge is being used to build. So we need to make sure that people in the social sciences acquire these skills that include things like elements of computation. How do you solve problems in a structured way using computing? You need to know something about the machinery of computing in order to do this. You need to know something about the languages of computing in order to tell the computer how to solve these problems. These are all very hard things. They're the sort of things that students will acknowledge they would like to know, but you know, everyone wants to go to heaven, no one wants to die. You've got to put in time for this, and that means it's very hard to fit that into the traditional four-year PhD or the one-year master's program or the three-year undergraduate program.
That's
a challenge for us.
Thanks, Ken. I'm going to come back to you. We'll do a fresh coat of paint in a moment. If I could ask Eva, if you wouldn't mind.
Yes, good evening. I'm from the law department, and contrary to stereotypes that may be present in this room, lawyers are very technologically savvy, and they're also an inquiring sort of folk, and we're very creative. So we're used to working with words, we're used to maneuvering our ways around obstacles, and we're also an inquiring profession. So the law and the people who do law is about finding out what's what, and that includes computer science. So the interface between law and computer science and between law and artificial intelligence isn't the problem. The computer science isn't the problem. Lawyers quiz experts, lawyers when they make legislation are able to come to a point where no stone is left unturned and we really know what's what. The problem at the moment is that the science isn't settled. So we're in a sort of state of flux where things move, targets are moving. And we know that there are a number of tasks that algorithms can perform. So they're, for example, able and they help us detecting patterns to identify credit card fraud, and they help financial services providers and, of course, all of us. They're able to interpret natural language, analyze natural language, detect patterns, infer from that what people like, what people are interested in, what people's views are on things, and that's all sort of an application. We can process information about certain topics, And we can also make promises that are automatically enforced. So we can create a computer science and an environment where promises don't need courts anymore to be enforced. And that's, of course, a very scary thing for a lawyer to think about. And then we've got sort of the idea of systems autonomously perceiving what's around them and reacting to that. And that's also something that algorithms can do. So we're seeing from a sort of somebody trying to design rules or somebody trying to work with the existing rules against that context, we find a lot of things that happen, the facts aren't settled. So and there's also sort of a bridge to build between the lawyers and the computer scientists. The computer scientists know a lot more, but they also are not fully understanding the scope and the breadth and the depth of the things that can go wrong. And I've got two stories to illustrate this a little bit. And one story is from a poem that we read in secondary school. And that was a really beautiful poem. It was a poem about the feelings people experienced in rural Austrian villages when the first trains came to the Alps and they built tunnels and the train sort of drilled its way through these mighty Austrian mountains. And that is a story about the train, and the train in that story was sort of described as this big, scaly monster with like, and it was wonderful, you could feel the presence of that monster, and he had like yellow eyes and steam was coming out of his mouth, and he was sort of slithering through these tunnels through the Alps, and he was delivering the souls of the poor Austrian peasants straight into the hands of the devil. So that was the imagery that was generated in this wonderful poem. And then our teacher decided to ruin everything, and she sort of made us do textual analysis. And there you can think GCSE and all sorts of stuff that the students, the sort of very young people in this room, will have very recently gone through. But in the context of that, and relevantly for today, we read a medical publication, and that was a sort of piece of advice written from doctors, and that advice was one should advise pregnant women, old people, and young children not to go on trains. And the reason was that those early steam trains were traveling at a speed such that we couldn't predict the effect this would have on human health. So that was a technology that came to us that was frightening and that we didn't know what to do with. And that was the advice that was given by the medical profession of the time. The other story I have has to do with asbestos. And there we went the other way, and it was not poetic at all. The law reports are full of cases that happened in the time from where we went, from a belief, and that was a firm belief, that this was a magical material. It was a silver bullet. We put it in people's houses. It was everywhere. And we thought, this is wonderful. This helps us do so many things. To a time where we are now, where for people to handle asbestos, there's a very rigorous health and safety process. And that process needs to be complied with because we have found this substance is very dangerous. It affects the health, and it affected very vulnerable people, a bit like the Austrian Alpine folk. This was about miners and factory workers who worked with asbestos who weren't adequately protected. And for that period in between, the law reports are littered with cases that concerned mining companies, that concerned asbestos manufacturers. And the question there was, what did they know? Were they negligent in not knowing what they knew? And did they adequately protect, for the knowledge they had at the time, the people they were responsible for? So the trouble that the poor lawyer is in, what are we going to do? We've got a moving technology. How is the reaction to this? And that concerns things like self-moving cars and whatnot. So that's the first question. We've got sort of something that is used, and how do we respond? How do we catch this problem of moving and volatile facts? And then the other thing that connects to systemic risk and is sort of perhaps more relevant for here today is, how can we make use of that technology for the purposes of financial regulation? And there, interestingly, the law is kind of a sort of trigger for why we would want to use the technology. So post-financial crisis, big connection to the Systemic Risk Center, a lot of regulation has been produced. So whenever you go and talk to some bankers, they're all like really, really unhappy about the sheer amount of regulation they've had to put up with. And also, there has been an advance in technology. So maybe we can put the two together and use technology for regulatory purposes. So for example, use cases would be financial services entities need to report certain information. And the way this works at present is that they collect the information domestically, which is already not as straightforward as you would think, because you have sometimes more than one computer system within an entity, because they merge, they restructure, so they have separate silos of computer systems. They need to take the information from that, put it in a report, and give it to the FCA, and the FCA's computer is called Gabriel, and the computer receives that. There's a lot of manual processes, a lot of analysis, and that costs money for the FCA and also for the regulated entity. So perhaps we could automate this. We could use artificial intelligence to go over these computer systems, bring up the data, and automatically forward it. Or, perhaps even in a more sophisticated way, we could just send the software over the systems, and they would work out which data is relevant. So we develop a system that works out, perhaps autonomously, what is important from the perspective of financial stability. And then that system could sort of do the work for, we wouldn't even have to specify what kind of data points we need. And then we can take it even a step further and connect this with building an analysis, perhaps even enforcing law. So you would have an autonomous system that crawls over the information that the regulated entities have, and then produces an analysis, and based on that, we have enforcement. So that would be sort of a future, you know, to some extent science fiction, to some extent not science fiction world, of use of artificial intelligence or sort of autonomous systems in the context of financial services. Now let me tell you what kind of legal problems would arise. So regulation is public law. This is about the government telling people what to do. And that has to be, there's sort of some things that public law needs to pay attention to. One of them is democratic legitimacy. So the process that generates law has to have some connection to democracy. The other one is regulators need to be accountable. So they need to have some way, they need to be accountable to the public. There must be some way of holding them accountable. And another one is that there must be a fair, accessible, and transparent process. So regulation has, there's a few more of these, but the three criteria that I want to focus here today is democratic legitimacy, accountability, and a fair and accessible process and a transparent process. So any software that harvests data from regulated entities has to be designed in a way that builds in that process into the software. So there has to be a way in which the regulated entity can, as it were, challenge the regulator, can challenge this system to sort of, you know, if there's automated enforcement. One thing that has been said about regulatory technology in this context is this will be very good, because we have a problem with the law. The law is too ambiguous. So this is something that gets on people's nerves. Lawyers use ambiguous terms. And sort of using computers instead of lawyers is great, because they will stop being able to do that. They will now have to speak in code, and code is a lot more precise. So there's a black and white, and there's a little bit of ambiguity, but not in the way that lawyers have ambiguity. And that's a benefit. And I agree with that. That is a benefit. So there is a sort of it's really important that lawyers are required to be precise about what they mean, especially in the realm of public law. There's also, and that may be a temporary problem, there's also a benefit in ambiguity. So ambiguity is something that can be used very skillfully, and that can be very important. And so, for example, very good example of that is the idea of regulatory alignment, or the term regulatory alignment, which was used when Brexit moved to this next stage, and that was to show that sufficient progress had been made. And all parties agreed that they couldn't agree, but they all were ready to move on. So they agreed to satisfy the sufficient progress requirement on the term regulatory alignment, and if you're cynical, you'd say it means nothing, and you would be absolutely right. But it served a purpose, and the purpose was to delay the decision. The purpose was to say, all right, we'll agree on this later, but we need to find some form that we can align something, and we'll thus discuss it at the next stage. So there is so ambiguity can help future-proof regulation. So those terms are something that can be useful. And the question then is, to what extent can this be replicated in this environment? Now, the next point I have is there's sort of one benefit of automating processes is said to be updating will become easier. So right now, regulated entities spend very much money in making sure they comply. So when the FCA issues some new elements to the handbook, they all sort of sigh deeply because they need to put in place a process of compliance. So they need to pay people to read this new stuff, to then processualize it, make it into processes that can then be used by that regulated entity. And that costs a lot of money, and that also makes it very difficult to change course. So perhaps a process of automation would make this a lot more simple, because all you would have to do is upload the latest version of the software. And this is wonderful, because we could then be perhaps a bit more flexible. So the regulated entities wouldn't have to, like, you know, maneuver like dinosaurs. They could very nimbly press the upload button, and hey, presto, the new framework would operate on their systems. And that, assuming this is possible, doesn't solve the whole problem, however, because the problem is also working out what to do. The problem is also understanding what's going on. What are the markets doing? How can we, you know, how does that affect the public interest? To what extent can we respond, and how will we respond? And for that, of course, artificial intelligence can also help. So we can also understand what the market is doing by using some data analysis, and that is something that's very helpful. But the problem here is that, of course, any analysis that is based on data is limited by the scope of that data. So in analyzing what's happening, we're, of course, through an automated process, and through data, we are limited by that scope. And this has recently gone through the press. So there's a problem with women presenting with heart attacks at hospitals. The reason is that doctors use information that is based on men having heart attacks to diagnose heart attacks in everybody. Women present with different symptoms and therefore are not identified as heart attack patients in hospitals because the data is just limited. So applications then, going and sort of making a recommendation on the to-do list of those designing these, they have to design in a way that the people who use it are very clear and have very clear signals what the limits of the data are. So this has to be done in a way that the limitations of the underlying data are made clear. Otherwise, we'll end up with new inflexibility. We'll end up in a world where our vision is perhaps even more limited than it is now, and that, of course, has implications for financial stability. So that's another problem. Another interesting point to make is there's this idea that automated reporting will do something beautiful. We will have real-time information. At present, the regulator collects data, for example, on mortgages, and that it takes some time for them to have the information. And if this was all automated, they would get it in real time. They would see, as it were, live on their screens what is happening in the financial system. And that is better, of course, than seeing the match 3 months later. But there's also a disadvantage in that. And the disadvantage is that with real-time information, there's an incentive to keep the regulator happy in real time, because you don't want to be in trouble. So you start gaming either the reporting process or, even worse, gaming your business model in a way that you satisfy the reporting requirements. And that then, of course, we all know, leads to short-termism. So we then end up in a world where long-term risk is overlooked, where medium-term risk is overlooked, all that happens is that regulated entities gain the algorithm in a real-time environment. And that is, of course, a problem. And then a final point, because there's limited time, but a final point is it's also important to remember technology is neutral. There's no silver bullet. The technology is something that serves those who program it, and of course there will be gaming. So that this is a game changer. But what is not going to change is the problem that the regulated entities ultimately make profit. It is their role in life to make money. This does not align always. Sometimes it does, but it does not always align with regulatory standards. And that is not something that technology will ever change. So this game of playing cat and mouse with the regulator and with regulation will continue. It would be wrong to say we've got the software and hence all's good. Gaming will not occur. I think gaming is a fun game that everybody will be able to continue to play for the foreseeable future. All right.
Thank you very much. The question is whether that game will be machine versus machine in the future. John, that brings us to you. You have a friend called Bob that you like to talk about. If I could just remind members of the audience, John is unequivocal in his conclusion that AI adds to systemic risk. Am I right in that representation?
Absolutely. So
he adds to that. So he's also...
We had a dystopian version of Eva's talk here. So what about Bob? So imagine the Bank of England is able to collect information from financial institutions in more or less real time and process the risk and the positions and everything else. And let's give this entity a name. So Bob is the Bank of England robot or bot, hence Bob. So Bob is the Bank of... And here's a counterpart in the United States. We can go to FOB in the Fed. The ECB has one, I can't find a good acronym, in Japan and everywhere else. And you have a similar entity in all the banks, in Barclays, in NatWest, in Goldman Sachs, and everywhere else. So you have these little robots or bots in charge of risk management. They know all the positions, they know the risk, they know sort of, they can suggest their trading strategies and the like. Now, what is to prevent this from happening? Absolutely nothing. So on a very reasonable technological progress, we can expect this to be possible within very few years. What will prevent this is the legal system, is the law, the politics, and social considerations. There's nothing preventing Bob from being operational very soon. The question then is, this is sort of the ultimate version of what Eva was talking about. The question then is, if Bob is in charge of the Bank of England from a macroprudential or financial stability point of view, are we better off or are we worse off? And I would say unequivocally, as Ludwig says, we are worse off. And what is driving this fundamentally is that the most complex system I think we have ever encountered as human beings is the financial system. And I don't think there's any other system I know of that is more complex. And when you have a system that's so infinitely complex, that creates a whole set of issues that are, I don't think, are not feasibly solvable by computers, no matter the trajectory of technology. And I want to mention two issues that pop up. First is that I'm going to use a technical term called procyclicality. Procyclicality means when we behave in a way that amplifies cycles. So we like to take risk when everybody takes risks. That makes everybody happy. That makes prices go up. And then we get depressed. We all sell at the same time. Risk goes up. And we all run away from the markets. So we naturally, as human beings, we act in a procyclical way. Bob will be highly procyclical. Bob will amplify the financial cycles. He will make us feel really good for a long time. Everything feels very stable. And all of a sudden, we get a huge crash afterwards. Now, why is that? Because Bob favors uniformity and best-of-breed processes. So Bob and his counterparts in other, both the public and private sector, they will favor a single approach to measuring risk, a single approach to manage risk, a single process for modeling the financial system. And that by itself, no matter how good the process, will amplify the cycles. And why is that? Because the problem is what stabilizes the system is not having a good system to control risk. What stabilizes is the fact that if I buy EVA cells and Ludwig is neutral and Ken buys, we want us all to be different. The more different we are as people in the system or as institutions in the system, the more stable it becomes. Bob pushes everybody towards uniformity, and that amplifies the cycle up and down. I think that's absolutely inevitable with any AI-based system. Now, connected to that is how does risk arise? Now, imagine the stock market today goes down by $200 billion as it did a few weeks ago. Nobody really cares except a few financial journalists. $200 billion loss globally is trivial. 10 years ago, less than $200 billion of loss in subprime mortgages almost brought the world to an end. Same magnitude of loss, but different circumstances. Why is that? Because we know about the $200 billion in the stock market. We are prepared for it. For the subprime, what happened is it's the intersection of silos. On one hand, you have subprime borrowers, then you have the securitization, you have the investment banks, and at the other end, you have the pension funds and the municipalities and whatnot who bought this stuff at the one end. So you have multiple silos in the system, all seemingly independent. The risk happened on the boundaries of where we are trying to control. Multiple regulators, multiple countries, there is no way an AI system can pick that up. Now, that's a natural procyclicality. Second is even worse, which is optimization against the system. Imagine you have a self-driving car. If everyone else has a self-driving car and you are not, you can take advantage because you know they will be safe, they'll react in a certain way, and therefore you can overtake and you can go fast. Because everybody has an AI car and you don't, that gives you an advantage over everyone else. That's optimization against the traffic system. Now, what about the financial system? Because if you want to control risk in aggregate, you have to have a really complicated, sophisticated computer system. A hostile agent, an individual within a bank, he or she, all they have to do is to find where the Bob is not looking. And remember, it's an infinitely complex system. So someone can always search for the one place they know Bob is not looking. Now, why is that easy? Because, as Eva said, regulations of law, they are necessarily transparent and slow-moving. So the hostile agents, they know how Bob thinks. And the more you know about how Bob thinks, the more easily you can game him. So therefore, Bob is easy to manipulate for hostile agents inherent. And then all they're trying to do is to make profit, a lot of profit. But they can also make a profit in the way that is inherently destabilizing. And if enough people are doing the same, then that can also create crisis. So I think the confluence of the procyclicality of AI and the optimization against the AI or against Bob means that the more you put AI in charge of financial stability, the more we will get boom and bust cycles and the more higher systemic risk will be. And I don't think there's a solution to that, no matter the trajectory of technology.
So Bob is susceptible to hostile agents. Sorry, I'm just tweeting that out.
Bob, uppercase, second B.
So procyclicality, it forces you to look for places where the regulators are not going, where Bob is not going. Would you mind just explaining what is it you mean when you say that the same positives of AI when it comes to microprudential are the reasons why they are negatives for macroprudential regulation?
What Eva was talking about was essentially what's called microprudential regulations. So if you take financial regulations, they're classified in two groups. Micro or microprudential is protecting the clients of banks from abuse if the banks go bankrupt or take advantage of you, sell you bad assets or whatever. Macroprudential is opposite. It's looking at the whole system to see if the whole system is taking too much risk that may give us financial crisis. So what Eva described was microprudential regulations mostly. Now, for that, AI is fantastic because they can take all the information, they can make sure we're not abusing people, we can make sure services are provided in an optimal way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's cost-effective for banks, it's cost-effective for regulators, and can easily, therefore, benefit society from the provision of services point of view. But that very nice property has an evil side to it, which is that that also gives you systemic risk because it will favor best-of-breed processes, as amplified cycles, and it will give the hostile agent more scope for optimization against it. So there are benefits and negatives. So in to use a financial terminology, Bob will lower volatility and fatten the tails. What that means is you get long periods of stability and then interdispersed by extreme movements. So instead of having sort of moderate movements over time, you get stability and big movements, a little bit like earthquakes, if you will. So the technical language is lower volatility, fatter tails.
Lower volatility, fatter tails. Okay, I think this is a good moment to try and see if there are questions in the audience. I believe we have a roving mic. So there's a gentleman over there at the back.
Thank you all. Is this on? Hello? Yes, it's working. Yeah, thank you all for your presentations. Very interesting. John, just on your comments, I wonder if you could say a few more words about why you think it is that these AI bots, which regulators at the Bank of England or the Fed might be using, why is it that there would be a tendency for them to all homogenize in a pro-cyclical way? Why could they not be programmed or given instructions such that they're wary of these pro-cyclical movements? So let's say all the banks are, you know, betting riskily on subprime or whatever the next thing is. Why can these bots not spot this and actually act in a counter-cyclical way?
So you wouldn't mind also just introducing yourself, please.
Yeah, sure. My name's Patrick Raleigh, and I work in the risk department at Bank of America Merrill Lynch.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's say, for example, that if you imagine two banks, and if the Barclays Bob talks to Bob, and HSBC's bot talks to the Bank of England, the Bank of England bot cannot legally give them different instructions. So as they start talking to each other, you have to give both banks the same information, because otherwise you are violating the legal structure of the regulations. So you have to harmonize. And the more you automize, the more you will move towards giving the same instruction. It's inevitable. The more quantitative you make regulations, the more technical it becomes, the less room you have for divergence or disagreement. And that is both inherent in how algorithms work. Algorithms will, if you ask Bob, what should you do? And by the way, there's a key element I did not mention. Will we understand how Bob thinks? Now, this is a key issue. Can an algorithm explain itself? Well, that's a tricky issue. So you will have to give Bob some autonomy for think by itself, and therefore you have to trust it to make judgments. And I would think almost any AI engine asked to optimize stability, they will optimize stability on the parameters they're given, and therefore they will push towards what it thinks are the best methods. It's both naturally how technology works and also how the legal environment works. So I don't think you can easily get around that.
Is it in any way similar to what you have with passive investing or algo-driven passive investing, where everyone follows, the herding is exacerbated when it's done through machines?
Yes and no. It is quite different. But imagine if everyone that did active investing had the same technology.
Active had the same
imagine
technology.
All the active people used the same algorithms, the same computers. They would all converge to the same place. And of course, I mean, you can see it almost with risk management. The students we educate in LSE, they all take our students in modeling. They all go out into banks. They all implement the state-of-the-art stuff they learn. And that in it by itself leads to harmonization. So the quantification and the universities and the education system pushes in that direction anyways. The AI will simply accelerate the process.
We have another question over here.
Right. Hi, my name's Joe Roussos. I'm a PhD student here at LSE. And the question I want to ask is also to John, a little bit about how I understood what Eva had said about how AI systems would come to deal with regulation. My understanding was that they would be a sort of representation of the regulation as lawyers had written it. And so I'd like you to say a little bit more, maybe, John, about why you think it is that it's more gameable when it's represented in this AI system, because currently regulatory systems are gameable, and the reason that they are robust is that humans can find those loopholes and close them. But presumably there would still be humans who would have to write and update the regulatory systems. And one of the things that I thought Eva had said is that that would happen faster.
I think Eva said the same as well, so we should ask.
Say a bit more about that. It would, of course, also be possible for the regulator to just issue code. So you do not necessarily need a translation process where natural language is transposed into something that computer scientists do. You could have a world where the regulator speaks in something that's more machine readable. But that, you know, doesn't deal with your question.
So it's all about who makes decisions. Because if you are going to leave an AI in charge of financial stability, it has to be able to autonomously tell HSBC or Barclays you're doing something wrong. And therefore, it has to be able to draw inference by itself, right? Which is the key element that would take us, which takes the humans out of that particular decision or even issue advice. Now, humans have the enduring ability to be fairly random. You wake up on the wrong side of the bed, you are in a bad mood, you go to the office and you get a query from the bank and you might respond to it in a negative way or in a positive way, or someone retires or goes on a holiday. So ask, just the flow of humans and their emotions inevitably creates randomness into the process that makes gaming harder. Some people are more attuned to it, others are less. The boss is more cold, more calculated, with no emotion, always get out of bed on the right side, and therefore becomes more predictable. I think that's inevitable distinction between having a machine making a decision compared to a human being making a decision. And therefore, and there's an equally important thing there, because at what stage do you stop letting Bob be in charge? So you have to, at some point, the human has to take over. So there are, the algorithms are, imagine you're driving. If you are driving, you don't know if I'm a lunatic or I'm stable, right? And therefore, you would be drive safely around me on the motorway. If you know my bot, you will feel more comfortable in exploiting me. And I think that randomness compared to determinism makes the AI bot more exploitable.
Tim has a question over there.
Thank you. I'm a graduate of the world's best social science university. Are we talking about circuit breakers? My sort of long experience of financial markets, every time we have a crisis, the response seems to be, let's introduce a circuit breaker. And so as we think about artificial intelligence and the kind of system, the kind of future that we've described, what are the circuit breakers? Is it just a question of pulling a plug out or throwing some sand in the wheels? What are the circuit breakers that we need to cope with a system that has artificial intelligence at its core?
Well, you have to have a bot in charge of the circuit breaker. And that is the problem, because ultimately, in the current system, if the market starts falling, right, we have a circuit breaker preventing prices falling, et cetera, all of that works well. But if you are a hostile agent on the other side, and you know there's a circuit breaker, you can optimize around it, right? So the fact that the circuit breaker introduces determinism, and therefore the AI has to deal with the determinism in some way, and that makes it harder to introduce the circuit breakers in an environment where you have more AI control.
So I have a question, but anyone else? Okay, the gentleman over there. And then one.
Hi, I'm John Wishmore. I did my undergraduate studies, my first master's in economics and then finance. I was a trader for a long time. The last 10 years or so, I've been working in machine learning. Just if it's helpful to say that in terms of determinism and responses to that, there are three kinds, but let's talk about two kinds of non-deterministic response. One is probabilistic, to say in the example that Ken talked about with distinguishing cats and dogs inside the system, when it's shown a picture, it won't say unequivocally dog. It will say 78% probability dog, 22% cat. And if you force it to choose, it will say, of course, dog. But inside, it's working on a probabilistic basis. That probabilistic basis was based on work by a physicist called Richard Cox in 1964. It's 54 years ago. For 50 years, machine learning has encoded doubt. We can say very formally that degrees of belief can be modeled as probability. It's a known standard, very far from deterministic result. In terms of regulations where humans can game, students in the LSE will know that game theory is very well studied and very well modeled for similar lengths of time to the probabilistic beliefs. In fact, probabilistic game theory in machine learning has been current for 20 years since I think Michael Kearns at New York University worked on it. So these are known things that are very, very, very far away from the deterministic work. And I offer this if it's helpful. Machine learning is much more able to deal with doubt and gaming than perhaps is being discussed.
More able to deal with doubt than humans.
Well, I mean, these are known, used technologies. Okay. When I say more able to, I'm being English and understating. They're known.
Cool. There's a question upstairs.
Yes, I would like to go back to one of the initial remarks from one of your colleagues on the panel. So first, Christophe Lelanou from Data Learning. I'm a consultant in data analytics. And that don't completely agree with Bob's conceptions and view, because I think Bob, as well, in a way, is conceived still in a deterministic view with the current legal system. So I would like to go to the initial remark, which mentions that we need to let computers develop their own intelligence and conceive a world where rules are different or where the intelligence is different, so to give a bit more trust in Bob to be able to detect malign agents directly within the system and to give us advance warning when people are behaving badly. So with some probabilistic on this way.
Do you want to respond to that, John?
I didn't quite. Can you summarize it, maybe? I didn't quite get it.
So you're taking a static view of this is what Bob does in where we are right now, but shouldn't it learn?
Now there are so both questions raise an interesting point, because I do know the traditional framework you are doing with machine learning, and I've estimated these models myself, and I'm quite aware of what you're talking about. But if you're dealing with a regulatory body, the rules change, because you cannot. Probabilities have to be assigned to a deterministic known action that is decided on by the regulator in a much more formal way than most other systems you encounter. So the formality of the regulatory process is inevitable, brings in determinism. And also, similarly, because in the type of system you're talking about, the system can adapt to the gaming and learn the gaming is happening. Can you leave Bob in charge of changing regulations? Do you want to let Bob decide on financial regulations, yes or no? I mean, that's a tricky issue. But to answer your question, you have to leave Bob in charge of changing regulations. Now, but if you do that, you're still left with the question of an infinitely complex system, which is a financial system, and a hostile agent who finds one niche and has one almost infinitely less, needs infinitely less computing power to optimize. All I have to do is to find the right spot to optimize against, so long as I know Bob is not there. And perhaps Bob can't be there because I read the regulations and I know he's not legally allowed to be there. Or perhaps Bob finds a niche that sits between United States and Europe and the UK. And he knows that the Bobs in these countries, they are not allowed to talk except in a partial way. You can optimize that. There are so many ways you can optimize this that the traditional solutions you're talking about will not work in this world.
let me just quickly rein on the idea of Bob writing laws. I think that would be a serious questions of democratic legitimacy there.
Exactly, yeah.
So which you obviously would agree with. And this also connects to another point I think that's relevant here, and that's the question is, who is it that leads the world in data analysis? There are many startups and they're all out there and they're creating these products and this is a vibrant market of small kind of businesses and we like them very much. But ultimately, there's a very concentrated market in data analysis and that is ultimately the market that will also be interested in financial services. And we're then introducing a business model into the financial services industry that hasn't previously been there. And that is sort of, and they are not necessarily any more interested in the public interest than the financial services providers are. So you have the likes of Google, who then will become involved in automating regulation and in helping to create analysis for regulators. And they then have a view of data, which is very valuable. And then they're in a position where they have some price pressures from the regulated entities and from the regulator and valuable data, and that is very tempting because the valuable data is not the regulator's data and it's not the data of the regulated entity, it's sort of the data of the customers. And that is a situation where I think a regulator needs to understand well what's happening, and that's a business model that we sort of bring into this sphere, and that doesn't sit very well with being democratically legitimized. So there is a sort of danger that the democratic process is then delegated to those who provide the technology, and there the law probably has a role to play.
I want to come back to you on legality or even the ethics of you know, data and surveillance. I just have a question for Ken. If you could just help us with, and at the moment, we're not in that world of Bob versus Fob and so on. So just practically speaking, in terms of where we are right now, some sort of a messy middle where some have AI and some don't, and some have deep processing capabilities and others don't. What could be some of the pitfalls? What are the limits of our methods of dealing with data that we need to be mindful of so that we don't take incorrect decisions?
One of the limits, there's a difference between the way that we would build a Bob or any other automatic system for interacting with an individual and the difference of how those autonomous systems would interact and produce what we call emergent behaviors. So it's one thing to have a self-driving car and go out there with a bunch of other humans and put that on the road and see how it behaves. What if the entire road is full of self-driving cars? The emergent behaviors in a system, and when John says the financial system is one of the most complex things that we have in existence, it's not so much because it's complex the way, say, a computer transistor chip is complex. I mean, those things are pretty damn complex. They have, you know, millions and millions of transistors. They're designed by engineers. They're tested. They're incredibly complicated. The source code for Microsoft Windows 10 is incredibly complicated. It's got 50 million lines of code. Humans design those, and ultimately you can zoom in and figure out why they were designed and there are little parts that fit together. The financial system is an emergent system. It's the interaction of a bunch of autonomous agents making decisions that produces collective emergent behaviors that can't necessarily be predicted, like crashes and things that we don't really see coming. If we could see these things coming, we would all make money, more money than we do, because it'd be easy to predict those behaviors. And by their nature, we can't. We're saying that we're going to replace unpredictable human behavior with possibly unpredictable machine behavior. So to take the example, the gentleman in the back said that machine learning produces a probabilistic estimate of, say, assigning a particular outcome. And that is absolutely true. That is how these algorithms work. You come up with a probability that you're talking about a cat or a dog. Usually that information, however, has to be translated into decision making. Humans make mistakes all the time. When I teach machine learning, I use a judicial metaphor when I teach what we call false positives and false negatives. So if the probability is that it's 80% that you've we presume someone is innocent until proven guilty. So the idea of a prosecutor, the task of a prosecutor is to amass enough evidence to overturn that presumption. What if there's an 80% probability? We're supposed to tell peers and judges, juries, beyond a reasonable doubt. But what does that mean? A computer may just use what's called a maximum a posteriori rule and simply choose the probability of the outcome that is higher than the others. And what if that is 51%, 49%? What is the emergent behavior of a collection of systems making decisions on a very marginal set of probabilities? That could very well lead to this sort of herd behavior crash situation that John was describing. So I guess what I'm saying is that the downside, the risk in response, Ludwig, to your question, I think, is that there's a difference between the individual behaviors that we think we're building into what we could call an agent or a Bob or some system, and the emergent behaviors when all these things are interacting in a very complex system. And by their very nature, those things are impossible to test in the wild. All we can do is simulate them, and those conditions are never entirely complete in the scenarios that we're able to stress test.
Do you have a view on the question that was asked earlier, that is it possible to build in circuit breakers in a system that might have unpredictable emergent properties? Can you design in advance that when you have this much concentration somewhere, you do something?
So what you do with a self-driving car, and I keep going back to self-driving cars because as I understand it, so much trading is already algorithmic. It's far dwarfs the trading that individual investors and human beings and Warren Buffett's are making. It's algorithmic. So we have a version of this operating already, but it's so complicated that most people don't understand it. When we get people letting their cars drive them around in a fully autonomous fashion, we're going to understand it. Because as soon as people start to die as a result of a self-driving car colliding with someone, then we're going to have these questions. It will be on the front page of the paper, and everyone will be talking about it. If you have a computer flying your airplane with no human pilot, and that plane were to crash, believe me, we'll be talking about it. When a human being crashes, we talk about it, but we don't question the entire nature of who's driving the car. So to come back to the... I got a little off track. What was the...
The limits of...
The circuit breakers, right. So the circuit breaker idea is one that sort of assumes that you're building a system where you can basically build in a pressure valve that gets tripped, but it's not that type of system. It's an emergent system. When a car encounters a situation, the way they're programming the ones at Tesla, when it encounters something that it doesn't know what to do, then it stops. But there's always a way to break the system, and there are always situations that the circuit breaker is not, in an emergent set of behaviors, going to be possibly able to anticipate.
Comment. There's a question at the back. And the gentleman over there. Let's take two questions together, please.
So, Andre from CyberRisk Consulting at Moore Stevens. So it sounds like a fair amount is about hostile agents probing around and trying to find the weak points in the system. But how would you say that's different from what's happening already? For instance, when George Soros broke the Bank of England, or when, let's say, these hostile agents actually are more beneficial to the system, where John Paulson made $5 billion off of the housing crisis. Okay. So how would you say it's
different? So how is it different? That's one question. The gentleman up there.
Hello. I just want to explore a little bit on the how you explain it with a self-driving car. Let's say there is a issue when there's an accident happening with a self-driving car, or there's also a human in charge of it. What if that human also have like a bionic arm or some kind of a chip, which could somehow like be injected into his, you know, finger, brain or something? I mean, in that case, would there be an argument of whether there is some whether this is caused by the malfunctioning of the chip inside a human body, or whether it is to do with the self-driving car itself, And if that's the case, is there something similar that in time could emerge in this kind of regulator or relation with Bob? Can we decide which is this something to do with the Bob, or it is to do with the chip implanted in the human operator of Bob?
Right. Let's take a third question, and then we'll come to the panel.
Hi, Anna-Luise Schröder. I actually did my PhD here in statistics, and I now work about half my time with the team on a situational risk model for autonomous driving. So I love that this, as an example, comes back over and over again. But my question is about Bob. So the concept of procyclicality, to me, in many ways, assumes two things. One, there's a deterministic rule. So you have a decision support that gives you, at a cutoff of 80%, a yes, and below that, a no. There would be a question around, could, if you don't want the market to play the system, could you use a smart randomization technique behind, right? So, I mean, probably there would be some concept related to the blockchain system that you could apply here too, and I would like to hear your thoughts.
Okay, so three questions. Sorry, do you have another one?
Yes, the other one was similarly procyclicality. As far as I remember from long ago when I took classes on financial markets, agents have different risk preferences, so there would never be a perfect procyclicality based on this, right? But that might be...
Okay. So, one question.
So I can... So
hostile agents.
So if I take them in the reverse order, I'll leave at least the last question. So you propose randomization as a solution to the problem of hostile agents. Can you imagine random loss? Would you want the Parliament of England to say, "I'm going to draw the law of today out of a computer"? You can't do that. The laws cannot be random by definition; they are deterministic, and that's why that solution does not work. But if you take procyclicality and the self-driving cars analogy, if I can make all the cars self-driving drive in the optimal best way, therefore traffic will flow smoothly. There'll be no traffic jam on the M25. There'll be no accidents. I can always get fast between A and B without any trouble. The object of a self-driving car is for everybody to behave properly, and then you can maximize throughput. If you apply the same rule to the financial system, you will inevitably drive risk-taking up to the point where you will get a crash. Exactly the type of solution you want with a self-driving car is pro-cyclical in the financial system, so it works the opposite way. But if you take the first example of Soros and the Bank of England in 1992, it's a fantastically good example of optimization against the system. George Soros knew that the Bank of England was defending the pound. Of course, it's a human being, but he knew that. He could optimize against the Bank of England and therefore make his £1 billion profit. That's a prime example of optimization against the system. Now, that is, of course, in a very particular circumstances. But if you move into the AI world, you will get many such opportunities, so it becomes much easier to do exactly that. So I think the George Soros 1992 example is exactly an example of optimization against a human decision maker, but you will get many. It'd be much easier to do the same under an AI system. Ken, maybe you can do the chip answer.
I think that humans are very ingenious at hacking systems and at breaking systems. And I hear a lot of people say, "Well, what about a technical fix to this risk? We'll put in a circuit breaker, we'll randomize." There's always going to be someone who's going to figure out a way to break that system. You can see on YouTube there. Someone's got a Tesla, and the rule is at the moment that you can put it on autopilot, but if you don't touch the steering wheel every 2 minutes, it shuts down the autopilot. Someone figured out that if you wedge a large orange into the steering wheel, then you don't have the 2 minute limit. Yeah. What engineer would have possibly anticipated that sort of thing? And people who want to bring down systems or cause attacks, we just saw that people exploited. The technology is never implemented uniformly or particularly well because humans and organizations are responsible for implementing it. That's what led to the WannaCrypt virus hacking our National Health Service. We've forgotten that this happened, 18 months ago. It brought UK governmental systems to a halt, not because it was a particularly genius technology, it was because people hadn't upgraded from Windows 95 or something, you know, that apparently is currently used on a nuclear submarine that Britain has. So people will find and exploit these problems no matter what we try to do, I think.
Well, let me answer the bionic question, because that's a big problem in the context of AI, because you've got code that's made up of various bits that have been created by different people, that is pulled together, assembled, and it's not very easy to sort of say, you know, who's done it, where's the responsibility, and you need a causal relationship for a tort claim to arise in those circumstances. And I think that may be an area where perhaps we need to do something, sort of change the law in a way that perhaps sort of has a presumption of liability or has some form of saying, in those circumstances, this is where the responsibility sits. And I cannot be more specific because it would also depend on the application. But you're absolutely right, causation is a legal concept that is challenged.
So it seems like in repeated cases, we're hearing that there are logical technology-driven solutions to things. You know, randomizing regulations was one, for example. But it's the democratic legitimacy, the social acceptability, which is a problem. So is it better to be in a dictatorial world, in a world of AI? Would you know, a Chinese system be more risk resilient in this setup?
Are you advocating Skynet?
Yeah, which can learn. I mean, at the moment, the limits to the machine learning is social acceptability. And in doing so, do you render the system more? Of course.
No, I don't think you need that. There are many reasons why an AI system will create financial crisis. And one of them is, of course, the need for regulations to be legitimate and static and et cetera. But the other, I think the more fundamental problem is that a hostile agent has an easier computation problem than Bob does. So, because Bob is if you think of it as an optimization problem, you're trying to solve the problem of keeping an almost infinitely complex system stable. While a hostile agent only has to find one niche and have one iota of computing resources relative to Bob, so he can really optimize on that one place.
Right.
And because Bob has to think about everything, right? And Bob, but you always optimize somewhere where Bob cannot compete with you. And if enough people do the same, so it's not a democratic versus non-democratic or random laws versus non-random laws. But I don't think a dictatorship would either want laws to be random.
Okay.
Sometimes it is the application of superior technology, and sometimes it's breaking a system with a much, much simpler technology.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, the classic story in the 70s was a guy named John Draper, and he was called Captain Crunch because he figured out how to make any free call on the AT&T network by blowing a small whistle that was given away for free in a breakfast cereal called Captain Crunch. And he just blew it into the phone and generated the tones necessary to use free long distance at the time there was such a thing, long distance.
Excellent. We have time for one set of questions. So, gentleman at the back, gentleman at the front, one at the back. So, we'll take these three questions. So,
yeah. Hi, my name's Greg. I'm currently studying computer science at the University of Notre Dame. John mentioned a topic earlier of not necessarily understanding how the machines are thinking or how they're deciding. So, in other words, if you were deciding, like, on an image set, why something might be 78% dog, or in a risk management set, why something over the other. We might have trouble understanding why the algorithm's choosing one over the other. And so, although there's been a lot of progress in terms of the accuracy of artificial intelligence, both in software and hardware, it seems that understanding why it's doing that has been lacking. So, do you believe this is important in implementing artificial intelligence into the financial system? And if so, do you think that would help systematic risk?
The two questions, one for John. Fatter tails associated with lower volatility. Fatter tails or more extreme tails?
Same thing.
No, no.
Conway can debate the probability theory, but it is the same.
No.
So would you say more extreme or fatter?
Yeah, we'll have a question. The second question was for Eva. Does this take us to legal personhood?
Say again?
Does this take us to legal personhood for these algorithms?
And the...
Yes, hello. Kind of a general question, but in terms of the hostile agent problem and finding, you know, the one iota of, you know, potential problems and such, could we not in turn use machine learning and such to play devil's advocate and look for those specific things and use that as an input itself into Bob or so on?
Okay. Who'd like to take which one?
Well, if you take the first question on, it's absolutely fundamental that you know how Bob thinks, because you do not, again, this all comes back to the legitimacy of the process. If the government decides to control our behavior, our society, you have to know how the government reasons and why the government is doing what it's doing. I don't think anyone would accept a government to make decisions completely arbitrarily without explaining why it is doing what it's doing. Or if the government tried to do it, we would vote in another government that would actually would explain it. So explaining how it thinks is absolutely fundamental to any regulatory AI system aiming to control society. While you don't need that for autonomous cars, by the way, and I think basically to take up on Ken's earlier point, we might get really upset about the first or second fatality because of self-driving cars. But there are 20,000 people who die in cars in the United States, and after the 10th fatality, we won't care anymore. Remember, when our computer crashes, we say the computer crashes. That's it. We recognize the fact that they're fallible, right? So we will accept that, but we will not. We need any control process over society needs democratic legitimacy. It has to tell us why it reasons in the way it reasons. And if to take the first question, can you use ML or machine learning to find the hostiles? Well, you can try, but if you have an infinitely complex system, therefore, by definition, the ML can only find a very small part of it. And remember, not only is the financial system infinitely complex, but exactly because of the emergent behavior Ken was talking about, the financial system is endogenously complex. Almost everyone who interacts with the financial system has a direct financial incentive to make it more complex. No one has a financial incentive to make the system less complex. Everyone wants to make it more complex. And because of the endogenous complexity, you can only search in a very tiny part of that universe.
Yes, so legal personality. So I teach company law, and we really don't know what companies are. So the question is, are they a contract? Are they an organization? Are they something that the state creates? But we do know what legal personality means, and that means sort of the bearer of rights and duties. And the question is an algorithm something that we can usefully give rights to? So can an algorithm own land? Can we sue an algorithm? I don't think we're there. I think the relevant, so company law is there to enable us to hold organizations accountable, to enable organizations to function, for organizations to be able to sue other people, for us to sue them. The question then is a digital autonomous organization something? Like, you know, are they, that would be a sort of an application where I can see a world where we would say, well, they're doing so many things that then at some point the law has to say, all right, we facilitate them the access to the legal system by giving them legal personality. Not the applications we've discussed here. Those were more sort of applications that help the regulator, that help the financial services. But you know, we are talking science fiction as well. And the way I think this would develop would be by, you know, somebody creating something that then interacts with the world in the way an organization does. So maybe no Google being owned by itself.
Would you like to?
it's a brave new world when it comes to this issue of legal responsibility, because you're absolutely right, John, that humans cause deaths in cars with one another every single day in massive scale. But there is also a huge concern with identifying who is responsible for each crash. You're driving an autonomous car. It causes a crash. Who's responsible? The person who signed the terms and conditions when they turned it on, and they allowed that, whatever, saying that, I was told it was safe, and it causes a crash and someone dies. Are you responsible? Is the company who programmed it responsible? Is the last mechanic who didn't service it correctly responsible? If you have a rogue trader who is doing something that they shouldn't, and they lose, $50 billion for an asset management firm, then that person is fired and goes to jail. What if someone programs an artificial intelligence type system to make those trades and it does the same thing with the client's money? Who goes to jail then? We don't know the answer to these questions, but we are going to confront them very, very soon.
Great. So just to finish off, I have one question, bringing it back to systemic risk. If any or all of you would like to give us a scenario where the next crisis happens, the financial crisis happens, as a result of AI. John.
You really know how to put a person on the spot here, Ludwig. You can really think about a scenario like we had in 1987. So, for example, a realistic scenario is if you have algorithms trading assets in financial markets.
Okay.
If algorithms, an algorithm are trained to react in a mechanistic way to each other. So this is not science fiction, this is today. So you can have a situation whereby trading algorithms start interacting with other trading algorithms on a massive scale. They will drive prices down, and because prices are going down, they will sell. And all of a sudden, the market closes because you hit 5 p.m. or whenever the market closes. So everyone has to write their positions really, really underwater. And then they will wake up, and they will have to decide, because the way you measure risk will react to the price fall. And the way you close your positions will put you underwater. And that will then create a panic the following day. And the algorithms will then react to it in yet another unforeseen way. And that is not science fiction. That is something that could happen tomorrow.
And perhaps it could even be in the 25% of the financial sector that is now in the shadow.
Absolutely.
Banking sector.
And right probably, so if that happened in the equity markets, probably have very little impact, because equity markets, they will tolerate almost any loss on a daily basis. But there are parts of the system that are not, as you said, with subprime, $200 billion almost brought the world to an end. So if you do have it, if it's in the right place, yes.
Any other?
Well, I've got one that didn't happen.
Okay.
And that was the millennium bug. So that was a situation where we all thought we've got a sort of engineering problem,
yes,
problem, and then nothing happened.
Great. Would you like to, or?
I think vulnerability of the infrastructure that we use for the information age is vulnerable to attack, and that could drastically affect the stability of financial markets.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And with that, we will bring this evening to a close. Thanks to the panel. Thank you very much.